and improvements. ADA and miscellaneous projects, assessment of capital needs, vehicle and equipment replacement, the water reclamation facility, and then One Harbor project. So again, if anyone's interested in getting more detail on any of these projects, you can click on the link that's provided in the director's report. And we have a nifty new online budget program. And so here now I'm in the capital project section. You can do 1 year, multi-year. We'll stick with the 1 year. And that's our proposed request, or that is our request. That's going to go to council for adoption on June 28th. And you can actually look at a lot of details about these capital projects. So for example, our pavement management program, or our Route 1, Route 41, Main Street intersection improvements, the storm drain stuff. So you can click on that and get a lot of detail, project descriptions and pictures. In many cases, we map it so you can see where it is, as well as a project justification, budget with future costs included in that, if a project has that, as well as funding sources. So it's a pretty nifty tool that I'm just plugging right now just because we're talking about it. But again, I did just want to call out that that was in the director's report for this month.
Okay.
I did have a couple questions regarding that. If you want to hear them.
Sure.
So the one thing I was looking at is the city vehicles. Is that like mainly for like the new water reclamation, or is that just kind of spread about like randomly, like, you know, different vehicles that are needed, or is that mainly for the wharf project?
I'm going to refresh my memory because we have over 20 capital projects. Let me see here. I don't actually think it was for the wharf, but I do want to look it up to make sure. Okay, because I'm spelling it wrong. So let's see. Just give me 1 second. So several water and sewer vehicles and a transit vehicle. So the transit vehicle, if we're interested, Janine is available, but we did receive a grant and we're going to be buying, I believe, a new trolley. And then there are some vehicles for water and sewer operations. I don't believe that those are necessarily connected with the wharf. Our vehicles actually are pretty old. Many of them are 15 years old. And so I don't think that there's a harsher environment, for our vehicles to be than right next to the beach, which is where they sit now all day, when they're not in use. And so they are, many of our vehicles are rusted through. We had one where actually the floor, under the driver, had holes in it, and you can see the ground underneath. So it's that level of a concern, and so that is what's in the budget for next fiscal year.
Okay, and then the other question I had was, and maybe I'm not understanding, but I thought the EV charging was mainly funded through like a secondary company, or is that, you know, like where the company kind of pays to do the infrastructure and then. And then we own it after, you know, the lease kind of thing is up. Is that?
Yeah, that's right. So there's two. You're a very good memory, because that's exactly what one of our EV projects is. So one of the EV projects is at Del Mar. And yes, the name of the company is Zero Impact Solutions. And the intent of their business model is that they can get some rebates and things like that from the state or through the utility company. But there is actually no cost impact to the city. The money that we're requesting for EV chargers for next fiscal year budget is for the project along the Embarcadero, which is a different project. It's funded through the air quality control, or no, Eric, help me out here, APCD, Air Pollution Control Board. And so in that one, we had already been funded by a grant, and that grant requires a match. What was not included in that grant, an unanticipated cost, was that PG&E told us that in order to supply power to those EV chargers, they actually needed to do a full design to get additional electricity there. Because there was an extra cost associated with that, there was also an increased match amount that was necessary there. So that's my understanding of that one. If I'm totally wrong on that, Eric, please correct me.
No, that's correct. They have not done their design, but you have to prepay for their design.
Sure.
And our best estimates is going to be about 40,000 of the city's contribution. The grant covered the charging infrastructure, being the charging stations themselves, not the actual power supply to right. that location.
So that money in the city budget is being matched by the grant. So that would be half of what the total is, you know, more or less.
Right. It's roughly half. I think it was 18,000 per site or something. You know, and there's two sites with multiple chargers at both sites.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. That's all I had for that.
I have a question, Greg. On the city streets, you're talking about the Highway 1 and 41, and you're allocating $1.7 million for the annual pavement. Is that still somewhere online to be redesigned? And is this just money that maintains it until it comes to that point?
So, yeah, that may have been a little confusing the way, and I kind of rushed through it. Let me share my screen again, because I want to make sure that's clear. We have kind of like funding buckets, and I lost that screen, but we had a screen somewhere that I showed you that said like city streets safety and improvements. And in that bucket, we had both the 141 Main Street intersection and annual paving. So those are two separate projects. Mm-hmm. And the annual paving is maintaining our streets and roads all over town. And so that is a request that we have for next fiscal year. A lot of that is actually coming from Measure E funds, and some of that is grant funded. The Highway 141 Main Street intersection, which is currently in environmental phase until next May, we still don't know if that's going to be a signalized intersection or a roundabout. Caltrans indicated that the preferred alternative is a roundabout. And we have an opportunity to get, I think, somewhere like around $6 million from SLOCOG to pay for a roundabout, or if it was a signalized intersection, proportionately less to what the total cost of the project is going to be. And so we are trying to save up money to fund our portion of that project. And we anticipate going to construction in that project in 2 or 3 years. And so every year we're setting aside $600,000 from, I believe, Measure Q&E funds to make sure that we have enough money to pay for the project on our end so that we can take advantage of the SLOCOG funding. So that's what that request is. We're not actually going into construction or anything like that next year, but we are still in environmental phase, which is going, unfortunately, slow, but it's one of the necessary steps.
I understand now. So the $1.7 million is for all the streets in town, not just for that intersection.
Yeah, I mean, it's more accurately, it's for some specific streets that actually Mr. Riddio is going to be calling out in one of the items during today's agenda. But yeah, it's to help manage all the streets in the city.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do we have to match that $6 million you said that's available from SLOCOG or whatever number? Do we have to match that?
It's not so much a match. We instead have a current project estimate, a cost estimate of around $8.5 million. And SLOCOG has this on their list of funded projects, and they're kind of maxing out what they can contribute, and we'll have to come up with the rest. So that's at this point, $2 or $3 million. We do expect, with the cost escalation that's been going on due to inflation and beyond that, the California construction cost index in 1 year, this past 1 year, went up around 25%. It's certainly going to be a higher project cost, but we will have to make up that remainder.
Thank you.
I just want to clarify that, as I understood, that our annual payment management, just to keep even, is supposed to be $2 million a year. Isn't that true?
That's true based on estimates from 2020. And so actually, it's probably more than that now. As I mentioned, California Construction Cost Index costs for construction have gone up approximately 25% in the last year. So yeah, it's probably more than that, but we don't have an estimate here in town, so we're still using the 2020 estimate.
Okay, well, I'm just representing John Urban, his comment would be, and that is, we're underfunding and slightly falling behind, it looks like.
Yes, and while that's true, I just want to call out that historically the city has spent $700,000 or $800,000 a year. So $1.7 million is a significant increase. I don't want to hide the fact that we also didn't pay for 2 years. So we're kind of also like making up for those years.
Yeah.
But it's our hope that in future fiscal years as well, we'll see a more robust investment in the roads.
Okay. Well, hopefully with our wayfaring signs in place, we'll have that much more revenue for the city. Okay.
And one more, just a little comment then. On the roads where the construction is being done, is that repaving of those roads included in the cost of the whole of that project?
Road and stuff. Oh, you mean with as part of the wharf project?
Yeah,
on Quintana. So, long answer, no. Short answer, yes. So, that road is never going to look as good as it did before the project unless we repave it on our own dime. The parts of the roadway that Anvil builders opened up and did trenching in and all that, they are going to be required to bring that to its previous condition. So they might have opened up a 10 by 40 trench on Quintana. So they will bring that 10 by 40 trench back up to grade. Now, there's going to be a little bump in the road there, and it's going to look like a patched road. And because they've dug up a lot of areas of Quintana, there's going to be a lot of those. And so to the, regular driver, it's not going to look like a new road. Anvil is contractually required to bring it up to its previous condition. So we are looking at ways that we can fund a project to basically repave all of Quintana. Initial estimates to do that, $2.5 million. That's a big number for a city like ours. So, we may have to segment that project or do something, but that's not something we're looking into for this upcoming fiscal year.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Director Kwolek. Before we move ahead, let's see if we can go back to our public comment and see if the video people have anybody in the queue. I don't know if
This is Janine. AGP is having some issues with their audio, so I will be handling the public comment portion.
Okay.
And I'm looking in the queue, and I don't see anyone that has their hand raised.
Okay. All right. Good. I just wanted to make sure that we get that opportunity.
Chair, if you don't mind, Janine, would you mind just for the record requesting public comment for the minutes and the director's report as well, just so we cover all our bases?
Do you want to take them separately or together?
I think together works.
Okay. Let me share the screen for public comment. And these are the instructions for anyone out there who wishes to use public comment. And let me just check and see if there is anyone in the queue. And I do not.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Janine. Okay. So let's move on to item A3, which is the review of the water reclamation contract amendments. Is there a staff report for this?
Yes, there's a report included in the packet, and there's also a presentation. And That's going to be given by Paul Amico, who is the program manager for the entire WRF program. But before he goes on, I'd just like to give a very high-level summary of what's going to be talked about in this presentation. So there are four contracts in question. Two of those contracts include new scope. So Cogstone contract includes new scope to the tune of around $370,000 for monitoring of cultural resources. And Anvil has some new scope. There's about six change orders, two of them requested by the city, four of them due to unforeseen conditions. But then there's a seventh change order that's actually a credit back to the city because of a regulatory change that fell in our favor, frankly. And so actually on the balance of the Anvil change orders, there will be a credit back of, I believe, $50,000 or so. And then there's two other contracts that need amendments, and those are non-compensable. Those contracts just need a time extension because we're coming up on the end of the fiscal year, and they both expire at the end of the fiscal year. I'll also mention that the Corollo contract, the staff is requesting budget to fully fund Corollo through the entirety of the project, including next fiscal year. However, staff will be bringing to PWAB a negotiated kind of itemized scope, hopefully in August, where we look at exactly what Corollo's scope is going to be in that contract. So without further ado, I want to thank Paul Amico for attending today and giving the presentation on these contract amendments. You can take it away, Paul.
Thank you, Director Kralik. Good evening, PWAB members and any members of the community that might be out there, which I don't know that there are any, given the extensive public comment we've been getting up to this point. I'm sure you all tuned into the council meeting last night, but so I'll try to be brief. It's the same presentation we gave to council. So let me share my screen or share the presentation. So again, my name is Paul Amico. I am the WRF program manager. I work with Corollo Engineers, as you can see over my shoulder here. So as I always like to do for these presentations, give it a quick presentation update, run through where we are with construction, how we're progressing before we turn to the contract amendments. So picture you see here on the right, great picture. You can see Pump Station A. This is Atascadero Road down, or I'm pointing, but I don't know if y'all can see it, but Pump Station A is in the lower part of the picture in the center along Atascadero Road. So Pump Stations A and B, A is the one along Atascadero Road, and Pump Station B is the one by Limos. As you can see on the left, rough grading going on at Pump Station A. The roof is on. That pump station has been green tagged, as we like to call it, meaning we're ready to start installing electrical gear, and then soon after that, PG&E will come to set the transformer and energize the station. Generally, we focus very, very diligently on getting PG&E in because PG&E's lead times are quite long, can be sometimes inconsistent. Anybody that's worked with PG&E knows that that is not an element of the schedule that we can oftentimes control. So we've been working very hard to get the electrical buildings up and getting those up so we can get through the PG&E process. Pump Station B, the roof going on in this picture here. So good. Construction's progressing very nicely. Pipelines.
So far, so good.
Do you need water?
Yeah, so far, so good.
Water be nice, please.
I'll get you some.
Yeah, exactly. So on the left picture, you see the microtunnel, which is the tunnel, the casing pipe we installed under the roundabout. This is where that tunnel machine was launched from. For many, many months now, that has been a hole in the ground, a very deep hole in the ground. And this pleases me to see that they're bringing this backfill up to grade. That means we are progressing. We're getting those pipelines in and putting that part of the project behind us. And then in the middle picture, they're pulling the sheet piles out from that area. And so that's the steel plates you see in the ground there. Pulling the sheet piles out, again, means we're progressing construction. And then finally on the right, our purified water line going in along Quintana Road over by the church down by South Bay Boulevard. So making good progress. Anvil has really stepped up. They've got a new team on the ground, new management team, new field superintendent. They're doing a great job. They really focused on schedule recovery. We've been working very, very closely with Anvil and Black & Veatch. As we talked about the last PWAB meeting about trying to close this gap between when FBV and Anvil, or when FBV needed sewage to come to the plant and when Anvil is going to get it to them. So they're doing a good job. Anvil's really brought things, turned things around. So in this, the pipeline's along the bike path. As you see the sign here, that's Main Street. So this is near the Morro Creek, or the pipe bridge here that you see on the right is probably this person's back. So they turn 180 degrees and they're looking here at the bike bridge. So things progressing, really, really starting to come together. On the WRF side, the actual facility, several of you toured the facility with us and they were getting ready to pave. As you can see, they paved the site. It's starting to look like more like an actual treatment plant and less like a construction site. And then on the right-hand side, you can see the water in the BNR tanks, or the aeration basins. We are now circulating clean water through the plant. It has been started up aside from having wastewater flowing through it. And so right now we're taking a very challenging situation in the delay between the pipeline completion and the plant completion for city staff to start training on all the equipment, running through different scenarios. They're really, as I said, taking the opportunity to do an extended testing and maintenance period on the plant, to really, really learn the plant before things get real, as they say, and wastewater starts flowing through the plant. In fact, I think in the coming weeks, coming days, actually, they're gonna start running the plant 24/7 to really simulate what it's gonna be like when wastewater is flowing through the plant. So great positive to turn out of a challenging situation. Any questions on construction project progress before we go into the contract amendments?
Yes, I'm interested in the fittings that were ordered and with the long lead time items for the bridge abutments.
Yes, we actually have temporary fittings that are going to come in. We've got temporary fittings that they're going to install, and then before the completion of projects, we're going to swap those out for the American Iron and Steel fittings that are long lead time. So again, Anvil really stepped up. Worked with us, understands the need for us to get this plant started up by October 1st. And so we're going to put one force main into service, have both force mains are going to be available, but only one will be placed into service. So when they swap those fittings out, they only have to deal with one live force main, or one force main that has wastewater in it. Because we have two force mains, we have the opportunity to switch flow between them. And so they can do one with clean, where they only have to deal with clean water, and then one where they have to dewater that pipeline to swap the fittings out. So those fittings are anticipated to come in November. So those will be coming in right before we hope to issue substantial completion on this portion of the project.
You're talking about the final fittings coming in November.
That's correct.
They've actually got temporary fittings. I guess it's access is easy to change them. Is that it?
Yeah, the again, because we have two force mains, we can take flow, we can take one out of service, put the new fittings in, and then switch them. They're just fittings at the end of the casing pipes. It was some eccentric reducers that we had to install. So they're putting in ones that aren't compliant with American Iron and Steel requirements initially. Those are the temporary fittings. And then the compliant fittings that are coated and lined and meet spec, those will go in as soon as they come in.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions before I move on? Okay. So contract amendments. We list the contract amendments here. Cox Management, they are our cultural resource monitors. They hire the Native American monitors that observe all ground disturbing activities, which is a requirement of the EIR, the Environmental Impact Report. Far Western Anthropological Research Group. Far Western does all of the archaeological work and clearance work that was required by the programmatic agreement between EPA and SHPO that was signed in order for the city to take federal funding from EPA through the WIFIA program. And then Carollo Engineers, our amendment to extend our contract. And then finally, the real meat of the presentation here, which are the amendment number 4 for Anvil Builders. So again, won't spend too much time on either Far Western or Carollo, but Cogstone and Anvil are the substantive amendments that wanted to present and discuss with you all. So again, Cogstone currently oversees all the archaeological and Native American monitoring during construction, and that was everything outside of the area that was that Far Western is working on, which is along the bike path and at the pipe bridge. Their amendment, this is the second amendment. We developed this amendment with them to cover what we call dig days from Anvil. This is based on Anvil's schedule for the number of dig days projected, plus some additional effort that we added almost as a contingency, but just in case anything went wrong. That was a base contract of $347,210 based on X, it's exactly on their schedule, right? X number of locations that they'll be digging, X number of days, including scheduling, other report writing, and so on from the Native American and other monitoring that, that Cogstone does. The optional tasks for $43,060 are to, those are controlled by the city. Cogstone, in order to access those tasks, has to request in writing that they utilize those tasks. And that would be for overtime or for additional dig days should anything go wrong or Anvil not meet their schedule. So total for this amendment is $390,270 with, again, $43,000 of that being optional tasks controlled by the city. Far Western, zero-cost amendment simply extends their schedule to June 30 or December 31st, 2025. So this is the work. Far Western has been working with us on the conveyance facility since about the 60% design, 90%, between 60 and 90. Once we got the alignments established, Far Western began the investigation that was required by the programmatic agreement. So they conducted a lot of different cores along the alignment to look for cultural resources and where those might lie in the ground. They were prepared reports and did a lot of interaction with EPA and SHPO, with the State Historic Preservation Office, very well respected in this space, and have done a very, very good job for the city, very well respected also by EPA and SHPO. So they are wrapping up the work on the conveyance facilities right now. They're actually clearing the area along Highway 1 to look for any cultural resources that are there in that ramp. Don't anticipate to find anything over there, but that's what they're doing right now, is to make sure that Anvil then can progress that work. The reason that we're extending their contract to 2025 is they have to do similar work along the recycled water injection sites, where we're going to inject over in the Vistra, along the Vistra easement that we obtained between the bike path and Atascadero, or in the Embarcadero. So that work would progress once that design work or that work would commence once the design work progresses to a point where we know where the alignment of the pipe is and we know what that profile is going to look like. And then Far Western will move through the same process they did for the pipelines and just do it on a smaller scale with the recycled water facilities. That's why we've extended that to 2025. Next amendment is Carollo Engineers, which is my firm. Extends this to next, at the end of next fiscal year. This is pretty typical for us. We go on a fiscal year basis, and we adjust our budgets as we go along, or our fee as we go along, to help cover us, to get us over the goal line for each fiscal year. We serve in a wide variety of roles for the city, including construction management, as we've discussed, permitting for the recycled water facilities. We coordinate a lot with the funding agencies and manage the disbursement process. We've been preparing a lot of grants for the city on behalf of the city recently, and then a lot of outreach work. So as Director Qualick indicated, we're in the process of negotiating our scope and level of effort for the next fiscal year, but we needed to extend our contract so that we could keep working for the city, and we anticipate completing our negotiation of our scope sometime in July, so we can come back to council in August with that. And finally, we get, one last thing I would note is this is a no cost amendment at this point. So, and I think there was a typo on that slide. It's not amendment number 2. I think it's amendment number 6. So finally, Anvil Builders, amendment number 4. Amendment number 4 includes 7 potential change orders. We've got, those were included in the staff report. The first one is PCO 11, which was rerouting the, we call it the IPR line. I call it the purified water line. Purified water line is the recycled, what's going to take the water to the recycled water or the injection site. And so those two lines, the IPR line and the water line, any water line relocations have to be away from the joint trench or the trench that includes the force mains and the effluent line, the effluent pipeline. At this particular location, there was a culvert that we knew about during design. The as-built information was not either unavailable or was poor, but you could see that there were head walls and then there was a culvert present there. So Waterworks went and potholed it. And when their subcontractor potholed that, they actually didn't find the center of the culvert. They found one side of it. And it turns out that culvert was an arched culvert. And we thought we could go, they thought we could take the pipelines over the top of the culvert. And it turns out the culvert is actually about a foot and a half taller than they originally anticipated. So Anvil had to put those pipelines under the culvert as opposed to over the culvert. The soil in that area is pretty particularly challenging to dig in, and so it slowed them down considerably. It took them several days to get through there, and so it resulted in a change of about $103,000, almost $104,000 to the original contract. PCO-19 is a pretty interesting one. I get the backstory on this as we were pulling this this description together. This is the desalination iron media tank. The one water plan that my firm prepared several years ago had actually identified that desalination was not a viable water supply for the city of Morro Bay. And so there was an old desal facility that had been decommissioned mostly by the city, by city staff over the last 20 years, 10 years. You know, it took a very long time to get that done. And this is the last piece of that old desal facility to be decommissioned. Interesting is that I've heard from city staff that a number of contractors looked at this, didn't want to touch it, didn't even give a quote to do the work. A few did, and it was considerably higher than this. So Anvil, because they're on site and they have crews here, they have equipment here, they provided a quote for just over $54,000 to remove this. The work has not been performed yet, so last night the city council did authorize this change order, so they will be removing that at some point during the contract before they leave town. As moving on to the next one, as Director Qualick had said, we got some good news, which was that some enhancements to the emergency generators, which we thought were going to be required due to California Air Resources Board requirements administered by the Air Pollution Control District. Our health risk assessments revealed that, showed the APCD that those tier four generator requirements were not going to be needed here. And so Anvil was able to credit us back the $300,000+ that they had gotten a quote to modify those generators. So the generators now can be shipped from the where they've been stored, and they can be placed in service here as we complete the pump stations. So some good news on the project there is we didn't have to spend over $300,000 to upgrade those generators. Paving repairs near station 102+50. 102+50 is over by Todd's Garage between Las Tunas and Kings. The pavement in that area is in pretty bad shape, and so there was some wet weather that had occurred at the time that the joint trench was being excavated. A lot of that pavement caved in that area, much, much more extensive than was originally anticipated, and cost Anvil some time there. So that was estimated around $6,900 to deal with the paving repairs in that area. The next two, PCOs 41 and 42, both on South Bay Boulevard. Cementitious subgrade on South Bay. I think this is over by Teresa Road, Highway 1 in that area. They encountered some subgrade for the road that had been treated with some additional cement, made it much, much harder than a lot of the other subgrade in that area. And it cost Anvil quite a bit of time to get through there to bust that material up, haul it off, et cetera. And so due to production slowdowns and other additional effort, about $26,600 in additional effort to get through that area. Down near South Bay and Quintana, they encountered some unknown conduits. They had damaged those. They didn't sever them, but they damaged the conduits, and they had some additional work to work around those conduits, getting the pipelines installed incurred some additional effort in that area to the tune of around $7,800 to deal with those unknown conduits. They had repaired those and put them, they weren't taken out of service, so they repaired the conduits as in their existing condition. The utility owner didn't mark them. They didn't ever claim them. No one ever came out to do it. So we just restored them back to the way we found them, because that's what you have to do when you encounter unknown utilities underground. And then finally, PCO number 49, Vistra and PG&E easements. We say unknown extra work items. So there was one, this is kind of an interesting name that our construction team gave to this, but because there was one item in there that was known, which is we asked Anvil to excavate a test pit for us over in the soil stockpile area so that we can have a place to go with injection, the test injection well production water. We're going to infiltrate that water in the ground. So they, or we were determining whether we could infiltrate that water in the ground. So they dug in some test pits for us to see how well that ground would infiltrate. So that the city could not have to invest a lot of money in either stretching hose all the way to the treatment plant or obtaining low threat discharge permits from the regional board for that. So the remaining items in this PCO all really have to do with unknown utilities on the Vistra property. Vistra did not have great records of the utilities. There were a number of different utilities that Anvil had encountered, had to map, had to pothole, had to work around, and in fact, made much more complicated and difficult by the fact that Vistra, we couldn't even get involved in touch with anyone at Vistra that really even knew about a lot of these utilities. So Anvil had to do a considerable amount of work to deal with unknown utilities along the lift station 2 alignment. So with those change orders, when we total everything up and count all the beans, it's actually a credit back to the city, a reduction in the contract amount for Anvil of $54,065. So that was what was good news on our part. It was our first change order that was actually negative to reduce the contract amount or reduce the level of effort. And in the end, what we had to do was to borrow contingency from the recycled water facilities, which was we had been carrying about $500,000, but because we had depleted contingency for both the wharf and the conveyance facilities up to this point, we had to shift money from the recycled water facilities into the others to cover these change orders. And so the remaining construction contingency after all the changes is $244,364.80. And as Director Pollack indicated, we will be, and we had discussed at the last PWAB, we're going to be bringing, or the council will be considering a revised WERF budget that will replenish a lot of the construction contingency so we can get across the goal line and not have to increase budgets in the future. So with that, I can take questions if you all would like.
Thank you so much, Paul. And that was a very thorough presentation. I just wanted to mention to the PWAB that Paul's correct. This presentation was given to City Council last night. Typically, we like to bring these sorts of amendments to PWAB first for review and recommendations to council, if any. We didn't have the opportunity to do that because of its time sensitivity this time around. So these were already approved by City Council, but staff is certainly interested if there's any input about these amendments and or change orders, if there's any kind of input from PWAB.
I just have a quick question. If they've already been approved, what's the utility of additional comments? Can they be disapproved?
No, they can't. But in my view, the utility of it is it provides us with input going forward, because we're going to be continuing to review amendments. And when staff brings these sorts of presentations to the PWAB and to council, there's a lot of decisions that are made behind the scenes, and what we actually see here in these presentations and in the staff reports is our recommendation. And so, you know, if there was sort of like a broader policy question about how we review these or what we're looking for in these change order requests, any input that we could receive from PWAB would inform that. So that's what we'd be looking for.
Okay.
Okay, Robert. Ian, questions? Jan no. Goldman? I think you're still there. One question I have for you, Paul, is the, of course, these great fittings and then now the replacement of the fittings. Is that where does that fall in these change orders or do they?
Well, we have not, we are still working through that with Anvil right now. The pipe bridge and the different changes that we've encountered around the pipe bridge, as I think we talked in the past, the bridge abutments were excavated under the supervision of our archaeologists because they did impact one of the, or they did encroach on one of our, cultural resource areas. So that area had to be supervised by an archaeologist. Plus the area along Highway 1 is being supervised by an archaeologist as we speak. So the total impact of all those changes related to that pipe bridge excavation, we have been talking to Anvil about getting their time impact analysis. And so all of that will be wrapped into that discussion, and a future change order would be brought, or amendment to the contract would be brought, that would be a global settlement of all of the different issues related to the pipe bridge. So the temporary fittings and the swapping out of those fittings, that would be incorporated into that, and we have yet to discuss that with Anvil.
All right, let's see. Janine, are there any public comments on this item? I don't know if Janine is.
Let me go check with Janine. Oh, there we go. She got it.
Thank you.
Janine, if you're saying anything, you are on mute.
Sorry about that. I am looking in the queue, and I don't see anyone who has their hand raised requesting to speak.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, is there any further board discussion on this item? Okay, well, there's no motion needed, so thank you very much, Paul. Let's move to item A4. Which is the water supply. And I think, are we going to have a public, are we going to have a presentation on that?
Yes. Yes, let me pull it up. Okay. And so, boom, boom, boom. Okay, I assume you can all see that.
Yes.
Thank you. So, yes, this is a presentation on a few things. It's sort of a composite or conglomeration of different items within one item. So I do have an outline of the presentation. Hopefully that kind of clarifies what we're looking at here. First, we're going to go through a brief water supply background for the city. And then we're going to review an annual water supply and demand assessments. That is a short-term look at our water supply and demand for the city. Three, we'll be looking at the water shortage contingency plan, which is a requirement through the Urban Water Management Plan, which was passed late last year. And we'll talk about that a bit. Water conservation efforts, some water strategies, and then finally, the water equivalency units recommended allocation. And this is required to be brought to PWAB by the municipal code. So that will wrap us up on this item today. So first, Moore Bay water supply background. Again, this is kind of general information. Moore Bay really has two sources of water right now. One is the State Water Project. So we are a subcontractor to the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District. The county gets water from the State Water Project, and we are subs to the county on that. So the county, the district, gets 25,000 acre feet per year from DWR at the state. And then the city and 10 other subcontractors have a contract to deliver 4,800 acre feet per year, as well as 5,700 acre feet per year as drought buffer. So that totals somewhere around 10,000 or so. And the remaining of that 25,000 is 14,000. And that is just stored in a reservoir as what's called an unsubscribed allocation. So, fun map. This was in your packet. Also, here we have broadly San Luis Obispo County. Over here is Morro Bay. I hope you can see this. The California Aqueduct, which runs roughly parallel to the 5, branches off into the coastal branch. Goes through a few pump stations, comes up to the top of the pass here, and at Polonio Pass, that state water gets treated for drinking. So it becomes potable water there, and then it is brought down by gravity all the way down to the city of Morro Bay through the Chora Valley pipeline at the end there. And that is where we get our state water from. And then the other water supply the other source of water that we have is through the Morro Basin. So that comes out of the Morro Basin well field near Lila Kaiser Park. We have 6 wells. We're currently permitted to extract up to 581 acre feet of water per year in the Morro Basin. Now, that doesn't mean that there's 581 acre feet in the ground, but that is the maximum that we can extract per our permit. That would actually only meet about half of the demand. If all our water came from that basin, that would meet about half our demand, because our demand is around 1150. And this is at max 581 to extract. So there are elevated levels of nitrates in the water in the basin. And because of that, the water has to be treated through the brackish water reverse osmosis facility that you see pictured here. This is on Atascadero Road. And if we extracted all 581 acre feet per our permit on any given year, 25% of that water is lost through the treatment process. It gets rejected as concentrate and just goes directly into the ocean. So if we extract 581, we'd lose, 130 or so acre feet a year, just to kind of give you a picture. So those are our two water supplies, state water and water from the Morro Basin. That's kind of a general look. Let's talk about our annual water supply and demand assessment. This is a requirement that we submit this. By the California Water Code. It's submitted to DWR July 1st of each year. This is a new thing that came with the latest version of the Urban Water Management Plan, as I mentioned, that we brought to council late last year. And it's an evaluation of our water utility's ability to reliably provide water for the current year and for one additional dry year. That's just kind of the model that they make us use. And the results inform the utility on how to implement their water shortage contingency plan, which will be discussed later in the presentation. So let's again talk about state water. So where are we at right now for fiscal year 22-23? Well, you may have heard that this year, due to the drought, we are at only a 5% allocation for this calendar year. So we were only allocated 180 acre feet of state water for 2022. So our normal allocation is 1313. Our drought buffer that we purchase every year, is 2290. You add those together, multiply by 5%, and you have 180 acre feet. So that's not a lot of water. The city, as a district subcontractor, can access its own stored water, stored state water, and the district stored water from San Luis Reservoir. So I'm just going to scroll back up on this map. What you don't see in this map is way up in the north, there's San Luis Reservoir. And as was mentioned, the city purchases 2290 acre feet a year of drought buffer. Well, we almost never use that. And so when we have 100% years, that water gets stored in San Luis Reservoir for us. So again, we can access that water in dry years. And that's what we are currently doing right now. Now we're almost out of it. And so what does that mean? Well, that means that that unsubscribed allocation that I mentioned in the beginning of the presentation, sorry, I'm scrolling around a lot, but I mentioned that out of that 25,000 acre feet per year that the district gets from the state, the subcontractors are only getting around 10,000. Well, that remaining 14,500 goes into this unsubscribed allocation, which really means it's just sitting in San Luis Reservoir. And during extreme droughts like the one that we're in now, they have told us that, they will make us whole this year. And then at using that unsubscribed allocation. So then they're doing that for all of the subcontractors in San Luis Obispo County and Santa Barbara County that have state water through the coastal branch. And so the district anticipates that at the end of 2022, at the end of this year, we'll have approximately 7,000 acre feet left of that unsubscribed allocation for all the subcontractors, which is, as you can see, sorry, I'm scrolling around a lot, and there is a slide that is a lot clearer at the end of the presentation, but I won't go to it yet. The subcontractors need 4,800 a year. So after this year, there's still going to be 7,000 more acre feet of unsubscribed allocation available. In other words, we will have enough water until the end of calendar year 2023, with presumably some extra for the following year if there's any left. So that's for the 22-23 state water for Morro Basin.
Greg, yes. Would it be, would you prefer us to hold questions or as we go?
How about when I get to the end of this section, I'll see if there's questions.
Okay, I'm just worried I'll forget my question because there's a lot of numbers there.
Yeah, do you want to go ahead and ask it now? That might be.
Well, I just wanted to see if I'm understanding correctly. When you say through the end of 2023, does that mean that all of the previously stored water will have been used? You talked about the buffer and the unsubscribed water that would be stored in years when it has not been used.
Right.
I'm just trying to understand if that means we're ending up with zero stored water at the end of 2023, if that's what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to answer that in two ways. This is sort of back of the napkin math. So When the district says that they're going to have 7,000 left at the end of this calendar year, and we know that they'll need another 4,800, so technically on paper it would be 7,000 minus this would give you around 2,200 acre feet. That's what the district would have left for subcontractors. Now, that's obviously not enough to give all the subcontractors a whole nother year of allocation. So it's not that at the end of 2023, the district will be at zero, they'll be at 2,200, but that will not be able to make all the subcontractors whole.
How long has the buffer water been accruing?
Yeah, and I see what you're getting at, is if they're holding 14,000 a year, I mean, we should have like a million acre feet in San Luis Reservoir. And I do have Dan Heimel here, as well as Damaris Hansen, but I'm going to try to explain this the best I can. The state spills the water every so often, and that spillage is not an actual spillage, right? They're not like releasing water necessarily. It spills on paper. So when the stored water comes to a certain point, they just say, okay, we're just going to bring it back down to zero now. So, you know, what's actually in the reservoir is not necessarily this 7,000 at the end of this calendar year. That's what it is on paper. But on paper is what's available to us officially, right? So Dan or Damaris, do you want to add anything about how and why the state spills water?
Go ahead, Dan.
So the reason the state spills water is because they characterize it as it gets in the way of the operations of the state water and the Central Valley Project. And so the basic principle is that the state will store as much water in San Luis Reservoir as it can until it interferes with the operations of the larger projects and their ability, along with the Central Valley Projects, the federal regional water supply project that takes water from the Delta, their ability to maximize utilization of their infrastructure to move water from the Delta down to the San Joaquin Valley in Southern California.
So Dan, though, is it correct to say that at the end of this fiscal year, if on paper we have 7,000 acre feet stored in, and not we, I mean the district has 7,000 acre feet stored in San Luis Reservoir, that in actuality there's a lot more of our, what was considered our stored water in that reservoir. It's just not necessarily available to the district any longer.
And I don't know if that's necessarily the appropriate characterization. So right now the district has, I think it's, what did we say? It's 12,000 acre feet of water stored in San Luis Reservoir. And based on its projections, at the end of this year, it'll have 7,000 of that 12,000 total left in San Luis Reservoir. And so that would be 7,000 acre feet of wet water that would be available to San Luis Obispo County District subcontractors for the year calendar 2023. And you were correct that would leave a balance of about 2,000 available for the following year. And that's the most conservative estimate, right? That's an estimate of us and the other subcontractors only relying upon that stored water and no additional state water being generated in calendar year 2023 and 2024. So in essence, that's a worst case scenario, you know, and that's assuming that, you know, that we don't even have a 5% allocation, you know, in those years, which would generate additional water.
Okay, thanks, Dan. So I may have muddled up the paper thing, but does that answer your question?
I think so. And just I'm just trying to follow along. It's like you said, it's a lot of info. Thank you.
I'm confused by who are these other subcontractors? In other words, we're not talking just the city of Morro Bay. We're talking a bunch of other people, whoever they are. I don't know if that's Cal Water or Golden State Water or who.
So I'll show you right here.
I see.
So these are the subcontractors to the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District.
All right.
ISMO, Morro Bay, Oceano, et cetera.
Okay.
And while we're on this slide, we'll just go through it. You see that Morro Bay gets 13 acre feet every year. Well, I already mentioned our annual demand is around 1150. So we never use that total amount. And as we're going to talk about in a slide in a minute, in one of the next slides, the state water shuts down for 2 weeks to a month every year. And so we can't rely on state water the entire year anyway. So it's even less than that. So as Dan said, that 4,800 that is allocated for this calendar year and next calendar year, that's not necessarily what's going to be used, which means when we get to the end of calendar year 23, it'll probably be more than 2,200 acre feet left.
I have a question for
Dan. Dan,
I'm really confused when you said that when the water in San Luis Dam interferes with the water irrigation things like the Central Valley. So on paper they reduce the amount. So how does that change the amount that's actually there. Do they send that, some of the water from San Luis Dam over to the Central Valley Project? Or does all this happen just on paper, or is it actually happening in water?
So it happens on paper, and as Greg references, they call it a paper spill. So what? No water actually goes over the spillway at San Luis Reservoir. San Luis Reservoir is largely, it's an off-stream reservoir. So the Department of Water Resources and Central Valley Project, they control how much water goes into that reservoir primarily by how much they pump out of the delta into the reservoir. So it has a very small watershed that, actual watershed for the reservoir. So they're really unlikely to ever see actual spill there. And so that's why they characterize it as a paper spill. But for to optimize the functionality and the ability of those projects to generate water, they need to be able to store water in that reservoir during certain times of the year for release to the contractors in later times in the year. So storage, even just operational storage within a given year. And so it's when this long-term storage gets in the way of the operational storage that then we have a paper spill, and that water is taken away from, taken out of the state water contractor's long-term storage accounts. Okay. I should add that that water doesn't go away. That water is then made available through another characterization or type of water, Article 21 water, for agencies that could take delivery of that water at the time that it is spilling at San Luis Reservoir.
So it does physically leave the reservoir one way or another.
Yes. Well, I mean, so the state water system is complicated, as you presumably. I think what they do is that they keep that water there, and they account for it differently, but likely they would just let water coming from the delta flow on by and call that the spilled water.
So bypass.
Like send less than they normally would to kind of offset those water, the amounts. Is that right? Is that kind of how I'm seeing it? Like for the paper spill or no?
Yes. So
they can extend it in different directions when they need it, as opposed to having to just sit there so they can move it where they need it, basically. And then deduct the amount that they have to send later.
Yeah, so they have the ability, so both the delta is obviously where the water comes out of it's the starting point for the Central Valley and the state water system. And then the San Luis Reservoir is not that far downstream from there. And most of the customers or the contractors are downstream from San Luis Reservoir. And so to meet the demand request for the state water contractors, they can either take water out of the delta or they can take water out of San Luis Reservoir. And they choose which source to take from based on, what's the most optimal situation given current hydraulic and other conditions within the delta and where they are in the hydrologic cycle or where we are in the year.
Got it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan, for that clarification on paper spillage. That was really helpful for me as well. By the way, I didn't introduce Dan. For those of you that don't know him, he is a consulting engineer with the city on some One Water projects and also on the Wharf project. And he's a great asset. Dan actually helped write the Urban Water Management Plan when he was still a consultant with WSC, which is the name of the consulting firm, until he recently branched out on his own and created his own consulting firm. He is local. He grew up here in Morro Bay and now lives in Los Osos. So he's been a great benefit on issues like these that are very, very complicated and ever-changing with new laws and regulations. So again, thank you, Dan, for that clarification, and Jan for the question, and Ian. And Lori, are there any other questions, or can I move on?
I've got one other little question or comment. I was just wondering, so when the Wharf project is actually up and running, say 3 to 5 years, is that going to kind of offset some of this, you know, with us being able to kind of, you know, because are we talking potable and non-potable water from the state, right? And then we'll actually be filtering our own water?
Potentially. And so we're actually going to go through a drought scenario where we do start using recycled water in a later slide. So I'd be happy to take questions on that once we get to that slide.
All right, thanks.
Yep. All right, let me go back up and find where I was at. That's the map. That's the RO. We already talked about that. And okay, so here's that 7,000 acre feet of stored water that the state thinks that the state thinks the district will have left. That the district thinks they'll have left for its subcontractors, of which we are one. So that's state water. Morro Basin, what does that look like for the next couple of years? So very important, state water is an interruptible source of supply. For example, they can turn off the valve, so to speak. So they actually do that once a year. They do a shutdown for maintenance. Sometimes it's a week or two. This year, they've told us it's going to be a full 4 week shutdown, which does present some challenges for the city. And normally when they shut down, the city relies on water from the Morro Basin that goes through the brackish water reverse osmosis facility that was shown earlier. Now, I did mention that a 4 week shutdown, given the state of our basin right now would be a challenge this calendar year. However, the Central Coast Water Authority has indicated that they can provide the city with approximately 40 acre feet of water during this year's state water shutdown to help alleviate the strain on the Morro Basin. So that's very good news for us. And there are a lot of assumptions that go into the annual water supply and demand assessment. I'm going to kind of breeze through these. These are a little bit in the weeds, but certainly if you have any questions, stop me. When we did our assessments, we assumed the current conditions of 5% allocation from the district, or from the state rather, and we assume that same 5% allocation from the state for next calendar year. We also assume that state water shutdown we just mentioned, we would last the full 4 weeks, that 13.5 million gallons would be available to us from the CCWA. That we also assume that Morro Basin supply is there in terms of what's under our water rights permit. We also have this unconstrained demand estimates. Those were obtained from the 2020 Urban Water Management Plan, which was actually done in 2021. That's a long story. And that in our water shortage contingency plan, we implemented level 3 of constrained demand. So constrained demand means water conservation, that we're asking folks to conserve water. And it assumes that 20% conservation is achieved. So if anyone has questions about that, I would kick them to Dan, but if not, I'm going to move on. So this is one of the graphs that's part of the assessment. And I want to take a minute to walk through this graph. So the bars are the city's available water supply in any given month. So you see July, August, September, October, all the way to June of next fiscal year. And the green line is the unconstrained demand. Unconstrained means there's no restrictions on water. You can have as big of a lawn as you want. Restaurants can pour water into the streets. And then the blue line is constrained demand. So that's with our water conservation efforts that we have right now. And let's just talk about the bars again. So the blue part of the bar is state water. And the yellow part is the Morro Bay Basin. And then that CCWA stored water, that 17 and a half million gallons that they've committed to giving us in November during the state water shutdown is the green. So as you can see, in all the months except for November, during this forecast here, not only does our constrained demand never come close to the available water that we have here in the city, but even the unconstrained demand doesn't really come close. It's hitting at maybe, 75 or 80%. In some months, it looks more like maybe 60% or so. So the one trouble month that we have this year is because of the four-week state water shutdown. So we're going to have to rely heavily on our groundwater and then that water coming from the CCWA. And we still exceed, by about 15 acre feet or so, what our constrained demand will be or what we're projecting it will be because of that extra CCWA stored water. So just are there any questions about this?
Yeah. Sorry, you're not getting off easy today, Greg.
That's okay.
A couple questions. First of all, how frequently is CCWA water made available? And if that weren't available, what would make up the green bar?
Yeah, and Damaris can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think that the city has ever utilized in recent memory CCWA water. This is a concern that staff has been anticipating and has been in contact with the state about this four-week shutdown, which, I'll just say, it's not terrible timing. I mean, we are in one of the worst drought, I believe the worst drought ever on record. And they are going to shut down state water for an entire month. So it's typically a week or two. But they say that they have necessary maintenance to perform. And so we do have a couple of options. If we didn't have CCWA, we could potentially just drill a whole lot more into our groundwater basin. Now that might require some permits that we don't have. And so we would potentially be able to get waivers on those permits due to the temporary nature of the situation and the drought. We do potentially have a connection with California Men's Colony that could send some water our way. So there are a couple of options. Damaris, do you want to expand on that?
As far as the CCWA water being available, we reached out to them early on just to find out how long the shutdown was going to be this year, knowing that the strain on the basin. So they offered that water up to us. We've never, that I know of, actually reached out to them and asked for that water. They have it typically on storage in their tanks there when they do shut down. So would it be available in other years? Potentially. But, we reached out this year for that reason.
And then in terms of saying, we could drill more, how is the drought affecting the groundwater supply that's otherwise available to Morro Bay, I guess would be another question. And then I'll just give you my last one so then I can be done. The blue line that is with some water restrictions, are those voluntary or mandatory? And do you have data? Is it just an estimate like everyone will reduce 20%, or is there data showing that people do reduce by 20%? So two questions. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'd like maybe Damaris or Dan to answer the first one about how much more water could we realistically pull if we needed it out of the Morro Basin, and then Damaris to answer the water restrictions question.
So that blue line there is basically close to what our line or usage is now. So it's a little bit, more, but it's close to what we're predicting the water usage is going to be for the year. So it is with some conservation, but it's not like a lot more than that. So and the other question was?
Well, so I'll just, and okay. So right now we are under some mandatory restrictions that we're going to go over in a later slide. We're currently at level 3 in the city. So that's just to answer that part of the question. And then the other question was, I said that we could potentially drill more. We may not have the permit rights right now to do that, but in an emergency, we might be able to get something like that. And so I think the question was like, how much?
Well, I was just curious, like looking into the future and hopefully with the advent of the water reclamation, you know, facility that would alleviate some of the stress. But I mean, drought affects water everywhere. So when, in terms of the underground water, that the wells pump out, just if the future outlook of that is that the city would, you know, that will be a stable source, you know, projecting to the future, or maybe not so much.
Yeah, and I'll just comment that I don't think, you know, we could reliably predict how much more we can get out of the ground right now, but obviously the deeper we go, because we're next to the ocean, the saltier will be. And so then the question becomes, you know, treatment. So do you want to speak a little bit on that, Dan or Damaris?
Yeah, I would add that I think the reason for the heightened concern this year is partially due to the drought, but it's also driven by the dewatering activities that are necessary for the construction of the wharf project. And so there's extra demand being put on the Morro Basin associated with those activities. And that's why the city is taking a proactive approach to reaching out to CCWA, initiating conversations with California Men's Colony, so that it has mitigation strategies in place for when we're going through this, you know, longer duration shutdown than typically occurs. And so under normal years and shorter shutdowns, and even shutdowns that have extended this long, the city has been able to reliably access and count upon its Morro Basin supplies to provide water while state water is unavailable. But there's just some extenuating circumstances. You know, as Greg described, this is coming at kind of one of the worst possible times. You know, we're in a historic drought, as well as there are extra demands being placed on the basin associated with dewatering activities. And so that's why, you know, this exercise was good. It's highlighted a period of time when there is some potential vulnerability. And so the city is putting together, again, as I described, mitigation strategies to be able to provide water during that relatively short period of time compared to the, you know, the entire, the rest of the year.
Yes, and, thank you. Thank you.
And to your point, Lori, yes, the IPR program will be a huge boost and really allow the city to get through these state water shutdowns, either normal shutdowns or extended shutdowns or potentially unanticipated shutdowns that could last longer than a month, because of the city's ability to recharge the groundwater basin while it is relying upon it for water. And so the IPR, and as Greg will show in later slides, is a critical component of the strategy for getting through drought periods and extended state water shutdowns in the future.
Yeah. Turns out to have been a very good investment, I would think.
I have a question about that, because you know, when we toured the plant, you know, I know that the creating clean water is an option, which we're not always going to be using. I mean, it's going to be there. How are we going to go about deciding when we're going to create the clean water to recharge the basin?
I'll just answer that briefly, because there is a slide that's, I think, more appropriate to talk about that, but it's through exercises like these that we'll be looking at every year. So this water supply and demand assessment is an annual thing. And so we'll have the opportunity to look at that every year. We have to submit it to the states. We bring it to PWAB, we bring it to council, and even planning commission, because it's associated with the water equivalency units, which are also part of this presentation. So yes, this will be an annual exercise.
Greg, before we leave this slide, I just have a quick question about the savings. Each month, as we save water, does that accumulate somewhere that we can then utilize it later?
Yes. So, yes. So any state water that we don't use goes into San Luis Reservoir and basically is available to us in the future. Dan, I don't know if you want to expand on that a little more intelligently.
You're right. I mean, the portions of the colored columns above the demand line represents surplus water potentially available to the city during that month. And so if that water's not used, either it stays in the groundwater basin and available for potential future use, or it's unused state water that, it would be retained within San Luis Reservoir for potential future use. There's a slight nuance, in that it's a lot of that stored water, at least in this drought scenario, is district stored water. So it gets retained for district's future use, but as a subcontractor to the district, the city has, along with the other state water subcontractors, first right of refusal to that water.
But, sorry, I have one quick additional question. Sorry. I was pondering when you mentioned that the reverse osmosis treatment that's required loses 25% of the water, which doesn't sound super efficient. Are there newer technologies to reduce those losses that you guys are kind of looking into or keeping tabs on?
Dan, you want to take that one?
Sure. Yeah. There are newer RO technologies that are being developed that have a higher recovery percentage. They typically require multi-stage treatment, meaning you take there are technologies that are being evaluated. There are also other operational strategies that the city has available to it. It would require some piping changes, but there are ways to blend the product water that comes off the reverse osmosis facility with raw well water and still meet all the water quality objectives and reduce the losses while that system is operating. So I would say there are both newer technologies that are out there and operational strategies. I think one of the things that the city's really looking for as it moves forward is with the IPR project, there's the potential ability to improve the water quality within the Morro Basin such that the reverse osmosis facility might not need to be utilized in the future. Right now, the RO facilities is solely being utilized to remove nitrates, and with sufficient injection of advanced purified water, which has little to no nitrates, as well as reduced nitrates coming in from the upper valley associated with new required ag management practices and reduced nitrate loading associated with ag. Ideally, we find a scenario in the future where the reverse osmosis facility is no longer necessary, in which case that loss, that 25% loss, could be eliminated entirely. But it's going to take time to see how the IPR water changes the water quality within the Morro Basin, as well as how effective these new ag management practices are at reducing nitrates in the Morro Basin.
Oh, got it. Thank you very much.
Any other questions before we move to the next slide? Okay, well, that concludes the section of the annual water supply and demand assessments. Let's talk about the water shortage contingency plan. So this is a document that the city must put together annually. It guides the city in identifying anticipated shortages and implementing the appropriate water shortage stage or response actions to allow for efficient management during our water shortages. So I'm going to go through these stages. This is what we'll be referring to when we talk about, with water conservation, what stage are we in? So stage one is just normal water supply conditions. Again, you can basically do what you want with water. And so I won't read through all these. In stage two, that brings us to moderately restricted water supply conditions. So water can't be used for cleaning driveways, patios, parking lots, sidewalks, streets, or other such uses, except where necessary to protect the public health or safety. And outdoor irrigation is prohibited between the hours of 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Also, all consumers are directed to use no more water than necessary to maintain landscaping. So that's stage two. Stage three is severely restricted water supply conditions, which is what we're in right now. So marinas and waterfront installations, use of fresh water to wash down boats, docks, or other incidental activities is prohibited. Emptying and refilling of swimming pools and commercial spas is prohibited, except to prevent structural damage and or to comply with public health regulations. Use of potable water for compaction or dust control purposes in construction is prohibited. And any dysfunctional water fixtures in public or commercial facilities must be repaired within 3 days of receipt of notification by the city. Stage four, outdoor water use, except irrigation. So washing cars by hose is prohibited. You can use a bucket. Outdoor irrigation of private and public landscaping, turf areas and gardens is permitted at even numbered addresses only on Wednesdays and Sundays, and odd number addresses on Tuesdays and Saturdays. And then finally, stage five is emergency water supply conditions. And in that case, the city council can impose whatever restrictions they want. So all of these stages, our movement in the stages, take council action. And so, you know, ideally, I just want to do an aside with PWAB. We'd like to kind of review these things with PWAB. There may be cases where there's just no time. If things were to get really bad, or, you know, if obviously we got a bunch of rain dumped on us or something, then that may go directly to council, depending on the PWAB or council schedule. But ideally, we'd like to take these things to PWAB. And so certainly, if there's any input on it today, we would welcome that input. But right now we're at stage three, and staff is going to be recommending the city council that we continue on stage three based on the assessment that we already talked about. So those are the stages of the water shortage contingency plan. Let's talk about water conservation. So, before we do that, are there any questions about the water shortage contingency plan and the stages?
Just, do you guys have a measure of compliance with the stages? Like, do they achieve the targets?
Yeah, so I'd love Damaris to chime in. My understanding is we don't have actual targets. It's more limiting and restricting certain activities of water use. Can you comment on that, Damaris?
That is correct. The water shortage contingency plan has percentages that if the amount of reducing, so like 20%, you are at a stage three. If it goes to, I want to say 40 to 45 or something like that, you go to a stage four. It does have percentage there. So like we're getting to the point where the governor says to reduce 20% or go to a stage two. We actually are at a stage three at that point. So there are some percentages in there for reduction in water use.
And to Damaris, for a point of clarification, because there's a lot of stories in the news right now about, you know, Cambria and other cities. And I think Cambria is right now at a stage two, and then Pismo is at a stage four. Are those, like, are these stages apples to apples?
Yes, I believe so. I think the water shortage contingency plan made those all the same across the board. Is that correct, Dan? I think we had to kind of do a crosswalk between those when we created that plan.
Yeah, so DWR established its six stages that it wants to see, and each of those stages has an associated reduction in demand tied to it. However, in development of the water shortage contingency plan, DWR, sorry, the Department of Water Resources, the regulatory authority over this, did allow agencies to kind of come up with their own stages. And as long as they showed how their stages tied into the six DWR stages, they could retain, have fewer stages, so they could have five or four or three. And so, unfortunately, it's not, depending on which stage they're referencing, it may not be a direct apples-to-apples comparison. And then also, these agencies likely have different restrictions associated with the different stages. So, you know, there may be stage two may require certain water conservation activities for one agency, whereas those water conservation restrictions may not kick in until stage three for another agency. I did some quick polling just based on some articles in the Tribune here recently. And, you know, I think at here locally, Grover Beach is at a stage two, Los Osos Community Services District is a stage three, Cambria CSD, I believe, adopted a stage two, and then Pismo Beach is at a stage three for reference for the PBAB to where other utilities are at with respect to their water shortage contingency plans.
Thank you again for that clarification, Dan. Any other questions on the water shortage contingency plan or the stages? Okay, if not, I'm going to go into water conservation. So you may have heard in March that the governor was asking urban water suppliers to implement stage two of the water shortage contingency plan. And to target 20% conservation when compared to the year 2020. And then in May, the governor added more aggressive water conservation measures, banning watering on non-functional turf. What is non-functional turf? So that's typically turf that's in the medians that doesn't really have any use. It's just for aesthetics or like ornamental, I've heard it said. A grass field in a park has a function. A lawn in front of one's home has a function, but then there's other turf that does not. So that's what that was referring to. The city conservation efforts. So last July, almost a year ago, the city voluntarily went into stage three, and we've actually never come out of that. So we are still in stage three, and we're going to be recommending to council that we stay in stage three. However, we are not currently meeting the 20% reduction that the governor has asked for in comparison to calendar year 2020. We're not alone in this. Statewide, water usage is actually up 19% from the year 2020. Now, why is that? 2020 is a very problematic year to compare to use as a baseline year. That's when the pandemic happened. Tourism went away for a few months, then it came back. People weren't going to work in offices and things like that. People weren't traveling. They were staying home. They weren't going to restaurants necessarily, hotels and things like that. So what we actually saw is in some months, we are exceeding the 20% reduction. But then in other months, we're like 30% over from 2020. As staff was just sort of looking at the relationship of our usage this calendar year compared to 2020, there was sort of no rhyme or reason. It was just like up and down. And again, our conclusion from that I think people are seeing this up and down the state is that it really has to do with 2020 not being a typical water usage year. So it's really kind of hard to use that as a target, but nevertheless, that's what the governor has asked us to do. To let you know what some of the city's water conservation efforts are, and these are led by Damaris and her team. We do put out materials to hotels and restaurants. You may see in some of our restaurants in the city that they're only putting out water upon request, and they may even have placards at the dining table there. This one, I believe, is going out to everyone that gets a water bill. Is that correct, Damaris? The Save Our Water one?
That one will be going out in the July bill, and it also went out to all the visitor service, all the vacation homes and stuff like that. It went out to them as well, and along with some other information for them.
Okay, very good. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the Unicode, that section, the restrictions that we're in, it states that the city provides to all visitor serving facilities water conservation material. So these are some of the material that we provided for them.
Thank you. And here's some other materials that we hand out. So these, I believe, go to the hotels and the inns in town to help tourists understand the situation we're in and conserve water. So that ends our section on water conservation. Are there any questions?
I do have one question, and maybe you're going to answer it later, but I noticed along the Lila Kaiser, you know how you guys are running the non-potable water? And so are we like stubbing that up in every single possible, like, you know, city, you know, parks and things like that, that we can maybe take advantage of that while those pipes are being run?
Yeah, Damaris, do you have some detail on that? I can answer it generally, but you may have more detail on it than I do.
I think what you're asking is if the water that we're returning back after we treat it at the wharf, if we're subbing that out?
Yeah, like the recycled water. Like, are we, like, you know, actively, like, putting that into the, you know, the city kind of infrastructure as we kind of go down the trench line that we can, like, tie into, you know, public areas in the future?
Yeah, that's different. That's a different process. So that's like your purple pipe water.
Yeah,
it's different. So the water we're doing is going to be for IPR, for injecting back in. You know, that would be basically recycled water, and that's a different permit process that the city isn't currently going through right now.
Okay.
Yeah, and just to piggyback off of that, and I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question initially. There will be those opportunities to stub off in the future, so that we can carry recycled water potentially to provide water for large fields and things like that. I don't envision in the near future any kind of comprehensive system where it's going all over town. I know that there were some requests that, you know, we look at all median landscaping should be using recycled water and that kind of thing. Well, that, you know, that would cost millions and millions and millions of dollars. And at this time, our rate structure would not support that kind of project. But there may be some opportunities to sub off, as you mentioned, and provide water in some areas that's still kind of cost effective. So we are going to be looking at those, but it's not part of the project right now.
Okay. I mean, you know, mainly I'm thinking of just like the, you know, some of these large trenches that, you know, are open, like if it's, you know, been talked about of, you know, maybe laying the groundworks for that, even if it's, you know, buried, that we tap into in the future. I don't know.
Okay, yeah, no, that's good feedback. That's a very good suggestion. Thank you. Are there any other questions on the water conservation piece?
My question would be, I know the high school has their own well, which they're using to irrigate their fields. How does that impact the aquifer? I mean, to what Ian is talking about, why wouldn't they use some of this water that's going to be injected, you know, I rather than pulling water out of the wells?
It's certainly logical that it, you know, we're going to have recycled water running right by the high school. Why draw water out of the ground? Why not use the recycled water? And so again, we will be looking at those kinds of opportunities. It's just not part of the current project.
All right.
All right, I'll move on to the next section, which is very short. It's one slide. So just based on everything we already looked at, what are our water strategies going forward. Number one, we're going to be recommending stage three of the water shortage contingency plan or higher to reduce demand. I don't remember why I put the word continued there. Continued demand, as in through. Dan, do you want to help me out this one? I do not remember why I put that word there.
Yeah, you put continued there because the city's currently at a stage three. Right. So it's, so I think the recommendation is to stay at a stage three and or, you know, evaluate conditions as we progress throughout the rest of the year. And if necessary, consider a higher water shortage contingency plan stage.
That's exactly what it was. Thank you. And then number two, utilize city and district stored state water to meet the majority of anticipated demand. And then three, leverage secondary water supplies during the November state water shutdown that would be coming from the Polonio Pass facility. So that is our water strategies based on the models that we saw. If there's any questions or comment about that before I move to water equivalency units.
This might be a water equivalency unit question. I'm not totally sure, but in everything you've just discussed, is that based on current usage or maximum usage if all the units were utilized? Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
Okay.
So that is definitely what we're going to be talking about in the next section. So if I don't answer that by the end of the next section, please ask that question again. Thank you. So what are WEUs? Not every city has this sort of thing. So the citizens in 1984 of Morro Bay adopted Measure F, which created this water equivalency unit program. And it was really designed as a growth management system. It regulates the addition of new water users to the city's water system. And it ensures the demand for water does not exceed the available water supply. So a WEU is a measurement of water, of water use that's equal to the average amount of water used by a single family residence over the period of 1 year, which we calculate right now at 90 gallons per day or 8,700 cubic feet per day. I'm sorry, 8,700 cubic feet or 0.2 acre feet per year. So that is, again, kind of an estimate based on average, but that's what we use. And what the Public Works Department does is we look at our annual water report, which this year is now called the Annual Water Supply and Demand Assessment, which we reviewed at earlier part of this presentation. So we prepare that. And then we look at, well, what is water going to look like for this year and next year, assuming another dry year? And that's what we're going to do every year. We're just going to assume the worst. And then, you know, do we have enough water to support new development? Because, however, the WEUs are issued during the planning permit process, not the building, the planning permit process. So if a developer wants to put in a new development, I mean, it could take 2-3 years or even longer to get that development in place. So it's during the beginning of that process that we look at WEUs. Really, the implications of WEUs are long-term. For example, we could allocate 100 WEUs this year, but none of those WEUs are actually put into effect because they're not built for 3, 4, or 5 years, or the project falls through or something like that. So sort of interesting, we're using kind of a short-term water supply evaluation and demand evaluation to make decisions about long-term water use. But we also are informed by what our long-term water supply outlook looks like. So let's look at, and this kind of goes back to one of Ian's questions earlier. I'll read this. The city relies on its urban water management plan supply and demand comparisons for future multiple dry year droughts to test adequacy of our water supply portfolio to meet demands, including the new developments that require WBUs. So this is a not just a hypothetical five-year drought or five consecutive dry years. This is based on when we ran the model last year, what was the driest consecutive five-year stint in the city's recorded history. And so we looked at those consecutive dry years, and we looked at kind of what the demand is and what the different supplies are, and just kind of how that would look. However, we looked at it at full build out of the city in the year 2045, and that full build out of the city is actually comes from the city's general plan, otherwise known as Plan Morro Bay, that is prepared by the Community Development Department. It was actually just adopted by City Council last year. So they are projecting that by year 2045, the city's demand will be 1,445 acre feet per year. So that's the demand. And then going into this chart, these are the available supplies each year. And again, this is assuming a dry year and another dry year and third, fourth, and fifth dry year. And again, based on that historical five-year period that was the worst in our history. So we're basing it off of a real-world condition that actually happened. So let's just run through this. You already know that every year, assuming we have 100% allocation, we have 1,313 acre feet of state water plus stored state water available and also groundwater. I believe that 407, if you remember, we had 580, we currently have rights for 581 acre feet to pull out of the Morro Basin. I believe the 407 is after the 25% reduction from the rejected water that goes out as concentrate. So that is dry year one. We're doing fine given the demand. Dry year two, you see that the demand stays the same, obviously, but we have less state water available. We have less drought buffer that's being stored for us. In year three, now we're down to 180 acre feet through state water, which just coincidentally is our allocation for the current year that we're in right now. Then we're using up that stored state water, which again is what we're doing this year. But and then we are tapping into our groundwater to kind of keep us whole for our water needs. And then according to the model, it is in year four when IPR would be needed to supplement our existing water supplies so that we can fully meet demand. So in this year, we have 720 acre feet of state water. We have 407 acre feet from the ground, and then an additional 317 acre feet coming from IPR or recycled water. And then in year five, things start to look up again, and we're able to get our 1,313 acre feet allocation, and that in conjunction with our groundwater meets our demand again. So this graph was actually presented in our urban water management plan that was taken to PUAB and the council last year. So it might look familiar to you. But maybe before we move on, if there's any questions or if anything needs to be clarified, we can take a pause now and hear that.
I'm just kind of curious, just kind of for myself, like kind of doing the math in my head, like how many typically like single family homes or are building, you know, or is Morro Bay building a year? Do you know kind of like a guesstimate of that?
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that, but the standard is, and this is on another slide here. I think I took it out of the presentation. So typically So we're usually allocating 115 WEUs a year for new development. And so that's actually what we're going to be recommending for fiscal year 22-23. 50 of those WEUs are for residential development. and 65 are for commercial.
And are they typical, like, commercial? Well, I mean, obviously depending on the building, but like a typical commercial building, like, is it typically less water consumption than a single family? I mean, obviously not like a hotel or something like that, but.
I would defer to Maris on that.
Yeah, so the in the Muni code, there's a table in there. So one WEU is a single family home, but the commercial and all the different types of commercial businesses and stuff, there's a certain number of WEUs that are allocated to that.
Oh, okay.
So like a multifamily home is 0.55 compared to a single family home kind of thing. So there's a whole table in there that tells you if it's a restaurant with seating, then it's this many WEUs.
Got it. Okay. Makes sense.
Does that account for ADUs, since that's just a little bit of a newer zoning thing?
Yeah, ADUs actually do not count in the WEU calculations.
Ooh. Are you concerned about that?
They can't be. I believe it's more of a state law because they're allowed by right, so you can't kind of regulate that in that way. And they're considered they go along with, like, say, single family home. Then it gets counted in that water use.
But presumably there will be more water use in that scenario.
Yeah, we looked into that quite a bit in the beginning because there are a lot of ADUs that get issued, but it came down to state law not allowing. Those ADUs are pretty highly regulated.
Yeah, but I mean, I think water is a basis to count them or restrict them or something about them. Just wondering since that was, you know, very recent.
Yeah, from what we understood, we weren't allowed to count them in the WEUs, according to state law.
I'd like to shed some light, and it might inform that question a little bit. It's something that's here in this slide. So last fiscal year, City Council allocated 115 WEUs for development. So that's a City Council allocation. That doesn't mean that's actually what gets allocated in development. So of the 115, only 8.94 were issued. So it's not that we're issuing 115 WEUs a year. We're just allocating them kind of if. And I've only been in the city for a year, but I've had many conversations with Damaris on this. 99% of the time, we never come anywhere close to issuing what the full allocation is. So there's sort of a perception thing here that I think gets mm-hmm. lost is that, you know, we're not actually, and also that 8.9 represented an increase of 1.78 acre feet for future years, right? Because this is, again, in the planning process. So if you kind of look back at this chart here, you know, 1 or 2 acre feet in the grand scheme of things, given our portfolio, and this portfolio is without recycled water, right? At this point in time, you know, it's questionable in terms of, like, well, how significant is that? Now, if we built out 115 WEUs, then yes, that would have a greater impact. But historically, that's just not what we see.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I think I guess I'm thinking of more just for planning purposes, you know, longer term scenario into the future. If you're not allowed to count ADUs and those, you know, proliferate, it seems that they probably are using more water, but it sounds like you have a lot of buffer before you need to get into those kind of concerns.
That's true. And one option we would have at our disposal, which we've done in the past, is we could change the calculation for the definition of a WEU to sort of absorb in conceptually, you know, what is the impact of ADUs in the city. So we're calculating it. I think it was at 0.2 acre feet a year. That is something that, we could reevaluate from time to time. Oh,
that's really interesting to know. So what period of time does was the calculation based upon? So you would have the ability to update that with recent data, I'm hearing.
That's correct. And that's what we did. And Damaris can jump in if we want to know the exact date. But I think it was 2016 or...
2016, I believe it was.
Okay, so that's pretty recent.
Yeah, the 90 gallons per capita per day is pretty much average for Morro Bay. You know, it fluctuates at certain times of the year, but that's pretty much the average still. So mm-hmm. It still seems an appropriate number.
Okay.
My understanding, too, with the 115, there's not enough space in Morro Bay to do that year over year. And so I know that that's kind of more of like a housing, and that's why the state, you know, really wants to push ADUs, as far as what I've kind of learned about it, and that's a big reason, because the housing crisis for finding people to live. So they want you to build the ADUs, knowing that a city like Morro Bay will never hit the 115 year over year because there's just not enough land, is kind of my understanding.
That's very much correct. Though I don't know that the state was necessarily contemplating Morro Bay situation, because this WEU thing is pretty unique.
I mean, like, that's why I know that you can't, like, dispute an ADU.
Right.
Oh, you know, it just kind of goes right through, and sometimes it's required, you know, to actually build an ADU.
Right. And interestingly, you're correct that, yeah, we never really hit the 115. This year we might have a bit of a different situation, because there are several developments that are being proposed. And so for that reason, we're required by the municipal code to actually take this same presentation to the Planning Commission, which we're doing next week, all before we go to City Council with it at the end of June. So it's true, in a typical year, we don't come near it. This year, you know, along with the drought, it just happens to be different. And there are many developments being proposed, but that are still in the planning phase. So the actual impacts on our water supply would be longer term and not necessarily short term.
Okay. Director Qualick, is that the conclude your presentation?
Yes, sir. I'll take any general questions
Ask for some public comment. Since we've all had a chance to talk about this, can we ask if there's any public comment on this issue?
No, but you can do that now. Janine?
Yes, I see there is one person's hand raised in the queue, Carol Truesdale.
Okay.
Just give me a moment and I will give her permission to talk. Okay, Carol, you can go.
Thank you very much. A very interesting presentation, and thank you and the staff for all the hours that you put into this. So as I understand it, this is basically based on all paper. Okay, there's no liquid assets we're talking about. So it's all hypothecation. So what happens if the state changes their mind as far as the allocations? And let's say there's a need in the Salinas Valley for the water for the food chain. How does that affect us? And it's like you, if you go to a bank and you have a promissory note for the future, there's no future or liquid assets in the bank, you don't get the dollars. I mean, shouldn't we be more prudent right now to start conserving more and more to make sure that this water resource of ours, which is so precious, to not just jump the gun and say, okay, we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. We have two new hotels that just came on board, a huge one off of 41 and Main Street. And let's face it, tourists are not going to be conserving the water. They're not going to be able to take care of showers in their own home, their own city. But here, they're going to utilize what we have here. This is our liquid assets. So I think it's time that you really, really put the pedal to the metal and do less than and not just bet on the paper allocations, but the true liquid assets. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Okay. Thank you, Carol. Good. Is there any further board discussion on this issue?
I don't have any additional questions. Hi, this is Lori. But I wanted to thank everyone for the presentation and the answers to the questions. I thought it was very well thought through and informed, and I found it extremely useful. So thank you.
I agree. Yeah, thank you guys.
Okay. So let's see. We need to make a recommendation to the council. Can I get a motion on this recommendation?
And so specifically, staff is looking for a recommendation with regards to our proposed allocation of 115 WEUs.
Is there any way, I'm just curious, is there any way we can add? I mean, I don't see any reason why we shouldn't go to the stage four. I mean, I don't see a whole lot of difference between three and four. I mean, you can't wash your car without a bucket. And we water twice a week. It just seems to me that maybe we ought to tie that together with this. I don't know if that's appropriate, but it sure seems like a simple thing to do.
I want to make one comment that I noticed that I think I made a mistake in that report there, because the stage we're at now is watering 2 days a week with those time frames. The next stage, the four, would be watering 1 day a week.
Oh, I see. You know what was written on that slide?
Yeah, that slide, I think I made a mistake on that because I was just glancing at it just now too. And that's the difference. So right now we are watering, we're allowed to water 2 days a week. And if we went to a stage four, it'd go down to 1 day a week.
And I would like to interject, perhaps we should have explored this a bit in the presentation. Our conservation efforts at this point in time would have a questionable effect on our water supply. And I know that might sound counterintuitive, but right now the majority of our water, except for in the month of November, is coming from state water. It's coming from stored water that was not ever allocated or purchased by us, but was in that unsubscribed allocation pool. And that water, if it doesn't go to us, is available to anybody else. And so if we can conserve, for example, 50% here, but that doesn't give us more water from the state. And so it's sort of a funny thing where we are in Morro Bay, where, if most of our water, if 90% of our water or 95% of our water is coming from, you know, another place, our conservation efforts do not necessarily impact our supply. So I want to make that point, and perhaps Dan could expand on that if there's interest from the PWAB. One of the reasons we're not recommending going to a higher level of effort in conservation is because of that fact. We do have water until the end of this year, and we do have water until the end of next year. So that again is the reason we're not recommending a higher level at this time. And in addition, it's consistent with what the governor is asking us to do. Sorry, I feel like I just dropped the bomb in the room, but I'd be happy to discuss that a bit if interested.
It kind of raised a question in my mind. If we can continue to take state water, and we are in the process of building injection wells for our personal groundwater storage, is it possible that we could send our overage of state water into our groundwater storage?
You know, that's an interesting question. I know Damaris and Dan might have a comment on that. The question again was, could we send our overage directly into the ground? That there's some hydrogeological stuff that might be questionable about that. But Dan or Damaris, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, I can weigh in. unique observation, and actually I think that there are potential opportunities to do that. So the city recently awarded the construction of a test injection well, which will be the first injection well as part of the IPR project. And as part of that construction, it will be doing an injection test, which in which case it will be doing exactly that, injecting state water into the Morrow Basin. Now, granted, the intent of that injection test is really for the purposes of better understanding hydrogeologic properties and to better inform the design of the full scale injection well network, but it will have the added benefit of injecting additional state water into the Morrow Basin and increasing the amount of groundwater and storage within the basin for potential future uses. Currently, that injection test is planned around, again, obtaining data to inform the design of the future IPR program. But I think, you know, there are opportunities and potentially the necessary permits in place to expand that injection testing if identified as beneficial or necessary to help the city get through an extended drought period. So, yeah, I think there are opportunities there that in the near term and potentially in the longer term that could be explored. I think the caveat there is this would need to be coordinated with the Regional Water Quality Control Board. They're the regulatory agency that issued the permit, and you know, and I think you know when approached for this permit, it was envisioned as a you know a test, not a sort of longer term operation. But I think that's an opportunity that could be further explored with them.
So just going back to the recommendation, if there's not an interest in taking a motion, that's okay. Maybe what we would want is just some additional feedback on, you know, on the WEU question. If there are any thoughts on a different level of allocation, that's certainly something we could mention to the City Council in our report to them. And further, if there is, as I think Chair Rogers already mentioned, maybe some input that we should be going to a different stage of water restriction, that's also input that we could take to City Council when we go with them. But really, if we don't get a motion, I'd like to at least be able to report to the City Council what some of the input was from this group.
Well, do you see any need? You alluded to the 115 normally, you know, being an extremely underutilized, but that this year might be different. Before we finish this out, could you elaborate a little on that? Do you expect that would actually come into play as a cap based on the applications you've seen?
Yeah, and I'll kick that to Damaris because she's a bit more familiar with some of the projects that are in the pipe. Damaris, to what extent do you think we might hit that cap of 115, or is it just on the residential side that we would hit the residential cap?
There's a couple of residential projects, and not necessarily maybe even being permitted too soon, but the Panorama project up there, that's I don't remember how many units now, but that's quite a few, but they most likely would be phasing those projects in as well. But that's quite a few WEUs that would be issued. There's some other potential ones that, you know, are out on the horizon too. I don't think we'll come anywhere near that 115 or the, but the single family and the multifamily numbers, I think there's a potential that, you know, some of those will be used up more than they were this year. But it kind of depends on how quickly things move through the process and everything. But, like, you know, yeah, it's hard to tell, but there's potentially some more projects out there, some larger projects out there that would be coming through.
So, Damaris or Greg, in the past years, we've always recommended that this be approved to have this high number of WEUs, and they haven't been reached. Do these numbers that we have okayed in the past, do they get stored up?
No, there is no carryover. So it resets every year. In the history of implementation of Measure F, they used to carry over, but that practice ended at some point.
Okay.
And I guess, you know, I think it's more up to, you know, the experts, obviously, you guys, but if there's a chance that a much greater number will be, in fact, implemented than expected, does that affect any of your planning, or is the planning resource still adequate to cover that? I guess I would punt it more back to you. And if you're comfortable that if 115 really did become implemented, you've accounted for that, then I would support that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think that was a comment more than a question. But I would say, just kind of bigger picture, that the planning aspect of this is something that, you know, would be under the purview of the planning department to deliberate on. It's not that we can't talk about it here, but whereas, you know, the reason this comes to the Public Works Advisory Board is really we want to give you a realistic outlook of, over the next couple of years, of our water supply and demand conditions. And yes, to chime in on your comment, we believe that 115 WEUs for the next fiscal year is appropriate based on the projections that we presented today.
Okay. Well, then, I mean, I would move to support or endorse that, or whatever is the appropriate language.
And I would second that move to endorse that.
Okay, I'll do a roll call vote. So Advisory Board Member Beal.
Aye.
Advisory Board Member Nava.
Aye.
Advisory Board Member Goldman.
Aye.
Advisory Board Member Gaffney.
Aye.
And Chair Rogers.
Aye, but I'd still like to see us go to level 4 on conservation. But
okay. So for WEUs, that's a 5-0 vote. And then on conservation, do you all want to deliberate on that one a bit more?
Well, I don't necessarily want to deliberate, but I would say that to me, washing a car seems to fall behind like keeping your favorite, you know, yard plant alive. So I'm not sure how that all worked out. I think that might just be me.
All right. Well,
I'm okay right now with staying at level 3 like we are, if that's where the state is and we're okay, we're functioning in that area. Okay, I think we can stay there now.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and move on then the next item.
And Chair Rogers, what I can do is just include some of your input as part of our staff report to City Council and to the Planning Commission that there was some interest in potentially moving to Stage 4.
Okay, thank you.
If I can make just a quick comment, I would also recommend maybe, with the mailers, I think that's a great idea, but maybe we just kind of, you know, in the next 6 months, we kind of stay on top of that, of trying to get more information to everybody about, you know, water conservation, I think would be a good idea, you know, so people don't forget when the summer ends.
That's good input. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for your comments and questions and for your presentation. Director Kowalik and, of course, Damaris, thank you. And for Dan, it was nice to hear from Dan, too. So let's, we have two more items to go, and I see it's just about 8 o'clock already. So on item A5, do we have a staff presentation?
We do, and that'll come from City Engineer Eric Riddio. I know some of the presentation was partly from the presentation a few months ago on pavement management. But we do need to put together a funding list for the next pavement management project, which is being proposed for next fiscal year that will be decided on by City Council. And we need to get that to the state by, I believe, September at this point. So we are asking for a recommendation for PWAP to provide input on this so that when we go to council, we can give them PWAP's input. But I'll go ahead and kick it over to Eric Riddio, City Engineer, to tell more.
Thanks, Director Qualick. Can everyone see the presentation? Is it coming through okay?
Yes.
Yes, okay, thanks. Thanks for hanging on, everybody. I promise to make it quick. As Greg mentioned, I am going to talk about a couple things we discussed at our March meeting when we went over some of the pavement 101, pavement management, where we're at with our current planning as far as our fiscal year 21-22 project, which is still in design, and then our next fiscal year project and going forward. So, am I on the wrong screen? Oh, hey, thanks. I had them reversed there. That should be better. This was a slide I shared with you on the first presentation back in March about critical point management, which means you really, with pavement deterioration, you really want to catch the pavement before it gets into the next category of treatment. And as you can see, the dollar figures increase as your PCI decreases as far as the what's required to restore the pavement. And again, this is the pavement deterioration curve. We are currently at a PCI of 61 for the city of Morro Bay. That's collectively all of our roadways, basically weighted average, which is not good. It's fair at risk. In 2020, when our last ratings were done, we were at a 66. So we've fallen quite a bit in this time. And so time is of the essence. We need to move on the projects that we have in line. And I'll go into some of that detail in a minute. This figure shows the ratings that were done from 2020 and a color code based on the ratings of different streets. Again, keep in mind it is 2020, so if you say there's no way Ironwood is a green, you know, very good, it's likely that it's over 2 years it's gotten worse. But anyway, the point of this is to show you that we have very good information from our pavement management system if you keep it current. So we have 2 years behind us that we need to get it updated, and we just recently signed a contract with Pavement Engineering to start and do perform ratings in July and August of this year. So we're moving on it quickly. We're seeing this as a high priority, and we need to know what our pavements, you know, the shape they're in to make the best decisions possible as far as treatments go. This is the south end of the city as well. So this was the five-year projection based on that data. Again, as Chair Rogers had alluded to, the $2 million per year, that was to keep it at a 66. Of course, we've fallen considerably. And the 61 is based on what StreetSaver, the pavement management system, is telling us based on the calculations it's doing. But again, we need to do the ratings to get a true accurate reading at what where we're at. So and that's again something we should do on an annual basis, but likely this number is going to increase with the construction cost, inflation, all of that, those things impact of course the cost of keeping this asset in good shape. And part of this process will be to update costs as well. So these costs are likely a lot lower than what it would cost today. So we'll be updating that with our consultant doing the ratings. So the projects, just to give you an update on those, the 21-22 arterial dig out hotspot repair project. We've removed the concrete improvements from that project. We've fast tracked that. We're doing about a $50,000 concrete project independent of that. And we've already got a contract signed for that. I can go into more detail on that at a future meeting. It'll probably be completed by then, but we're upgrading some sidewalk and putting in some ADA ramps down at the near the wastewater treatment plant. There's four locations where people regularly access the beach where we're putting in some accessible ramps, and then a couple of locations in downtown. So this project is $1.1 million budget. Final design is in process, and we're looking to advertise sometime in July with construction to probably be in the fall. This will also include a paving of the police department parking lot. They have some funds set aside for that, so we'll be adding that as scope since it's similar. Again, like I mentioned, concrete improvements have been separated out. We're also doing, as a staff within Public Works, ongoing mini projects, I call them, would be internal staff, and for a little bit bigger projects, maybe we involve an outside contractor. That includes skin patching and dig outs, asphalt berm to control some of the storm water, because as you know, many of the city streets do not have storm drain systems. And so we control a lot of the water on the roadway itself. Otherwise you'd have edges of roadways on hills, you know, washing out. Tuscan Road being one of them. We're doing a road edge stabilization currently internally at that road in North Morro Bay. For the fiscal year 22-23, what we're proposing to council for adoption is a surface seal project. Again, going back to the first slide with the cost of treatments, we're at a point where we need to, pardon the expression, but stop some of the bleeding. We need to get on top of some of these pavements that are in good or fair shape and get them sealed up before they advance to the next category of deterioration. This project will be funded by SB1 gas tax, as well as a significant contribution from Measure Q and E. Again, it's going to council for adoption with the budget. We hope that it will pass, but a very important measure for the city because about almost a million and a half of that is coming from that measure alone. So we have a preliminary project list that I've put together. It's in the staff report to the PWAB for recommendation to the council. And this is part of the process with SB1. The gas tax, you have to adopt a resolution every year by your city council before it goes to the state for allocation of funds. Some of these streets will be surface sealing the streets that are part of this dig out project. So the arterial dig outs are basically repairing the really bad failed areas that you see excessive cracking or actually failures of the subbase. We'll be digging those out and replacing with asphalt, and then sealing the whole surface of the roadway to minimize further deterioration. As I mentioned, it's a $1.6 million budget, $233,000 of that from SB1, the balance from Measure Q and E. And the surface seal strategies will be simpler. My understanding, and being new with the city, I'm still looking at some of the the past pavement projects. And I know that there's been many different strategies used with different layerings of treatments, triple cape seals and whatnot. But I think what I'm proposing is a simple seal, whether it be a chip seal on our arterials and collectors or slurry and residential, where we can cover as much pavement as possible. That's before, like I said before, before it gets into a more costly treatment category. We will have to look at some long-term issues with some of these pavements that are really struggling. And I think in future fiscal years, that will be a high priority. We will also probably be doing some crack seal with the contract and dig outs as necessary. I shared this at the March meeting as well, showing our arterial dig out hotspot project, which is Main Street, Pacific Harbor, and then parts of South Bay. Keep in mind, some of this is part of the wharf project, so that's the bit under the freeway. That's where the lines have been placed. That is not part of this project. We are looking at possibly doing a surface seal on that, since that's not part of the scope of the restoration, but we're still discussing that with the wharf team. The pavement management project for that I said with SB1 funded and also Measure Q&E, we're proposing a surface seal project. Again, this will surface seal streets that receive dig outs, as well as other heavily traveled streets, and then some residential as well. We have some of the streets selected, which is here on this corner of the slide. You can see some of them. It's a little hard to see, but we're still early. We haven't finalized that list. We're working on it. Again, part of that, the importance of doing that is to get our ratings done, our street ratings, and to know what our system is collectively before we actually allocate all those streets. Now, one question you might have is, well, do you have to have a final list to the state in your resolution? Well, you need to have streets in there. You need to have projects that you intend to spend the money on. But the state understands that that may change. So that doesn't mean that you have to do those lists or that list of projects. What it means is that you have to be transparent about what projects you're going to propose to use the funds on. If it changes in your project planning process, there's another opportunity later in the year when you do your expense reporting where you justify that and you actually detail what streets you did your projects on. So for the most part, you know, these streets that we're doing, the digouts and the surface seal, that's going to take a significant amount of the cost of this project. So we're pretty confident on the bulk of the streets that I've put in the staff report for recommendation. Again, we're prioritizing streets that haven't been surface sealed in the last 5 years. And we have some data to show in our pavement management system at what point or what year a certain treatment was done. So we would stay away from doing any treatments on streets that were after 2017, unless there was, unique circumstances to where there was premature wearing. It's a highly traveled route, and it really needed that in the eyes of the city and our consultant. Other streets selected using pavement management system and consultant ratings and recommendations. So that's why we're going to be doing the ratings up, pretty soon here, and looking to go to council for adoption probably in August, if not the first meeting, the second meeting in August. The complete streets list of streets will be developed by engineering and streets in coordination with each other and our consultant. And then we plan to bring a final list to PWAB prior to construction, just so folks are aware, and we can tweak that list as well if there's recommendations from the PWAB. And we do want to keep in mind, we want to distribute treatments of streets as equitably as possible throughout the city. Every agency does this a little different. There's some agencies that break up into zones. I think that was something that Morro Bay has done in the past, where they would only do certain zones in certain years and stick to certain areas. That is, for bigger cities, definitely a good strategy because it keeps costs down. If you have a contractor working in one area of town, they're not having to mobilize equipment and get it moved to other areas, and it provides some efficiencies. Being a small town like Morro Bay, we may not have that issue to where we can try to move and treat streets throughout the city in an equitable way to try geographically, I'm saying, as far as trying to spread some of the treatments as best as possible. The one thing to keep in mind, there are some, again, North Morro Bay, there's some real struggles with pavements up there. So if it doesn't make sense to do a treatment on a road, for instance, the slurry seal on a road that's not doing well, we would not recommend doing that just for the sake of doing a street in that part of town. So we will take a hard look at what streets qualify as far as PCI and are recommended for the treatment. And we'll be presenting that to the PWAB at a future meeting. And then it was brought up at the March meeting. Mm-hmm. Hey, I wanted to give you just a cost example. This is, and I looked, and these are pretty current costs. So this is probably about what it costs in current day dollars for a square foot of a chip seal, a slurry seal. So if you think of like a 500 foot, say a half a block by 30 foot wide, which is most of our residential streets, 15,000 square foot, it's $9,000 to do a surface seal. If you were to remove and just replace the asphalt, not address the structure of the roadway, not address the base or anything below the pavement, you're looking at just, $225,000 just to replace the pavement. So that's 25 times. That's the magnitude of the concern we have with some of these roads that are just structurally deficient. So I hope that was helpful, and I know it was quick and hopefully to the point, but we're looking for a recommendation of going forward with our list of streets so that we can propose it to council and get a resolution to the state. So any questions?
Yeah, I have, of course, my question is already what I said earlier. I mean, I'm certainly in favor of your list, Eric, but, I'm not happy that we're not even close to the $2 million holding number that we're supposed to be doing, which we know is going up. It's probably 2.1 now or 2.2 million. So my question is, are there any other potential methods that we could use in terms of grants or something else so we can get our, get some more money for the pavement that we, I mean, you already said, hey, $2 million, and we're at $1.6 million?
Yeah, we're definitely better. But we're it's still kind of a losing battle. I think we need to keep looking for grant opportunities, especially if there's streets that, in our downtown that have ways we can do multimodal improvements, and they would qualify under, say, an active transportation grant or something. That's something I'm committed to looking at. I know that there's been talk about that on, say, Morro Bay Boulevard, or maybe even Main Street, or section, you know, maybe look at the Embarcadero. But some of these streets that we can do streetscape improvements, the pavement, if you do these type of massive improvements, then the pavement can be added to the project as well. So that's an option. I'm hoping that some of these federal programs come through and actually can be used for local streets and roads. That's yet to be seen based on what I've heard with the IIJA and these other infrastructure bills. But we really need another program similar to the ARRA back in the early 2000s or mid 2000s, the ARRA, where shovel-ready projects could just go right to work. And, you know, you saw lots of agencies doing overlay project after overlay project and catching up on some of these. And really, that's something that would really help in this situation.
Thank you, Eric. Are there any other questions from our board here? Okay, Janine, I'm just curious if we have any public comment. Anyone in the queue?
There are no members in the public in the queue that are raising their hands to speak.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further board discussion? Okay. Well, then let's thank Eric very much for his work, and certainly encourage his work on trying to find further funding options. I think that's great. Okay, we don't need a motion here, so let's move on to our last item here, our business item A6, this ad hoc committee for traffic engineering. Do we have a presentation on that subject?
Yes, thanks, Chair. I don't have a formal PowerPoint presentation. This is just a verbal, and I'll try to make it quick. I know we're kind of going on the long end of our typical meetings, but I had talked with all of you at some point, either when you started or when I started, about my intention to bring more meaningful items to the PWAP. One thing that the new city engineer Eric Riddio and I have talked about for some time, certainly since he started, is what do we do with all these traffic requests that we get weekly? People are going too fast on my streets, the parking isn't set up right, we need more red curb, we need less red curb. You should widen the road, you should narrow the road, you should have a left turn lane here. And in many cities, there are things like traffic committees that review these kinds of requests. Certainly, I've worked at other cities that have a means by which these requests are heard in a public way. And that's not something we've had here recently in Morro Bay. There used to be a traffic committee in Morro Bay, some 20 years ago or so, and that was eliminated and sort of absorbed into the PWAP, but never really, there was never really a defined structure for how that was going to happen. And so, we're actually looking for your help, PWAP. We'd like to bring these items to the PWAP, but there's a lot of questions about what that would look like. Do we bring you all the items? Do we bring you some? Do you approve them? What do the staff reports look like? Is there an appeal process? If there is an appeal process, if someone wants us to put a red curb in front of their business, well, let's say the PWAB thinks that no, we shouldn't. And so staff doesn't do it. And can that person appeal? So If they didn't appeal, would that cost anything? So there's a lot of questions to work out. I've already been in consultation with our city attorney about this. And so Eric Riddio and I agreed, and Janine, who's been part of the conversations, agreed that the first step would be potentially, if there's interest on the PUEP, to form an ad hoc committee to look at this, to look at not necessarily traffic issues at this point, but to look at what would the structure be if we created something by where, for example, do we bring it once every 2 months or once every two meetings or something like that? So what would that structure look like? Let's define that structure, because once we create that structure, that's what it's going to be. And so it's not something we want to experiment with. We actually want to do a full evaluation of it. So we'd like PWAB's help with that on the staff side. Sure. And so, you know, our recommendation is that the PWAB deliberate on forming an ad hoc committee. That committee would have to be comprised of less than a quorum of the entire PWAB. So the maximum number of ad hoc committee members from the PWAB would be 3. But also on the committee would be myself, Mr. Riddio, our management analyst, Janine Burlingame, and potentially someone from the city attorney's office. So I'll leave it at that for deliberation. And again, the basic question is anyone interested in forming an ad hoc committee?
Are when you say for consideration, do you mean for debate right now or for consideration to discuss later?
I mean, for debate right now, what I'm ultimately looking for is if there's consensus that we should do this, that staff should start bringing these items, I'm looking for the formation of an ad hoc committee this meeting.
Well, when you mentioned having a right to appeal, under what authority are these requests being or petitions being brought that would give them a right to appeal?
Well, again, this is all potential, and these are the exact kinds of questions that the ad hoc committee would consider.
Okay. How about the idea of a member of the Chamber of Commerce being involved in this in some way?
On the table.
I mean, I suppose it kind of depends. Like, do you have some way of vetting these individual complaints to discern if there is more than like one individual at one particular time that has an issue? It seems like it could potentially be a resource issue to just respond to, you know, every grievance over some parking traffic issue.
That's a good question. Let me close my window here. That's a good question, and maybe I'll tip my cards a little bit and share a little bit more of our vision. So we do plan on bringing the a consultant traffic engineer on board to our team, who would work not many hours, honestly, over the course of a year, but who would be that kind of initial vetting. But ultimately, when we make decisions that have impact on an entire community, so our issue is this. If I get a call, or if Eric gets a call saying, I want a red curb in front of my business, we're setting, in a way, a policy about that particular location that we've only received input from one person. We don't have right now a public process by which to notify the people that it would impact and then bring that in front of a public body to say, okay, we have our traffic engineer's opinion about this issue. We have the person who brought the issue to our attention. This is their opinion, and they're welcome to the meeting. And we're also going to, for example, notice everyone in 300-foot radius that we're going to be hearing this question at a PWAB meeting. And so, and this is just an example of what it would look like. Again, the purpose of that. So, and then we would do that, and PWAB would be able to not necessarily decide or tell us what to do, but give their recommendation on it, and so on and so forth. So.
And would there be some sort of policy guidance or other documentation to guide the process or govern the process?
Yes, in many cases. They're already, some of that already exists. For example, there's a resolution passed by City Council about stop signs that we can't put unwarranted stop signs in the city. But then there's also the MUTC what that actually stands for escapes me right now. But so again, because decisions would be informed by the expert opinion of a traffic engineer, all of that would be taken into consideration. And when we would bring these sorts of items to the PWAB, that information would be presented.
And who would be the actual decision-making body that would make a final decision?
Yeah, again, this is something that we'd want the ad hoc committee to look at. But as it stands right now, staff has the authority to make these decisions. And so we can delegate that authority. That's what our city attorney told us. And, again, the kind of specifics and mechanics of what that looks like, I think would be sort of like, well, how do we want to do it?
So you'd be trying to make it more transparent.
Yes.
And uniform. Okay, I would support that.
Let me ask, when you say bring it before the PWAB, does that mean this ad hoc committee PWAB, or are we talking about our PWAB monthly meeting?
PWAB monthly meeting. So the ad hoc committee would only be formed to create the structure for how this works. Uh-huh. Once that structure is in place, we'd say, okay, starting, January 1st or something, we're going to do this every other meeting or every meeting or once a quarter. I don't know.
Would we have the authority to create like a process guidance document that would, be then accepted and available? Is that the goal? Because without guidance on, specifying and clarifying what the process is.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah. I mean, it could make it into the bylaws, or it could be like kind of part of a handbook. There might be a policy document.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly how we structure that is open to debate, but that makes sense that yes, we'd want some document to state, yes, this is what our recommendation of the process is.
Okay. Okay. Well, I would support that.
This is the purpose of this ad hoc committee, is to evaluate those sorts of things, as I understand it.
Yes, not the traffic issues themselves, but the structure of how the
to develop a process.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, very interesting.
Sounds fun, right?
Yeah, fun stuff.
I would be happy to help if wanted.
Good. All right. Well, that's, and I know we have some very good people on our board here that would be very, very good. But let me see if there are any other questions from our board on this issue. Robert?
No, I didn't really have a question. I do have a copy of the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices that I can bring along if I'm invited to join this.
Good. Okay, great.
Got a paper copy?
It's in a binder.
How thick is it?
It's a 3-inch binder.
We can scan it and distribute it, you see.
I think it's available also for free PDF.
Oh, good. Okay. Excellent. Okay, great. Any questions, Ian? Do you have any questions on this?
No, I don't think I have any questions. I would just be kind of, I think, a little bit more interested in kind of the process, which kind of, so.
Okay. Good. How about Jan Goldman?
No, I don't have any questions right
okay.
now.
Okay. All right. Let's see if there's any public comment on this subject. Janine, is there anyone in the queue?
There are no members of the public in the queue wishing to speak.
Okay.
Can I just interject something real quick? Sorry to
interrupt you. No, it's a good time.
I just wanted to add that Director Qualk and I met with Chief Cox and Commander Watkins as well. Obviously a lot of these issues cross the desk of police department, and it's very important to keep them in the loop, because what we found as well is, there's folks that will call anyone who picks up the phone, and sometimes they'll call police and it'll get handled, and then it, you know, that then it happens again, they'll call us. So I think it's important to keep them involved in this process. You know, as we look at the committee, PD is a very important part of this, and they've expressed, you know, that if we have concerns that come our way, that to definitely keep them in the loop. So
okay, that's a good comment. Is there any further discussion by the board?
Well, yeah, one last point. And I wanted to bring it up again because we had a little egg on our face with the parklets. I remember a short time back where some business owners benefited and others didn't. So including a voice from the businesses would be a wise move on our part. Have somebody to represent the businesses in this.
On the ad hoc committee, you mean, right?
On the ad hoc committee, yep. Right. Creating a structure to how these get reviewed.
We can certainly reach to Erica at the chamber and see if she, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if she might have someone who would be interested in participating in this.
Yeah, and just kind of to add to that, maybe even like a representative of each kind of, you know, governing body, then, you know, whether it be the tourism and the Chamber of Commerce and the, you know, the PD definitely. I think makes a lot of sense.
Well, that's great input. If tonight an ad hoc committee is formed, we can get to work very soon and reach out to the chamber, the tourism board, and PD, the attorney, and help put together this committee. So I guess what we're looking for is a motion to create an ad hoc committee. You probably want to figure out who here would be on that with a maximum of three. Then you can kind of set us loose on setting it all up.
Well, it sounds like we have some interest. So let's, can we get a motion to establish this ad hoc committee? Robert, sure, how I about will... you? Or Laura, do you want to make a motion?
Oh, I overspoke you. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. We're looking for a motion.
Oh, I would move to establish an ad hoc committee to evaluate traffic concerns.
Great. Okay. Can we get a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Excellent.
I'll do a quick roll call. Advisory Board Member Beal.
Aye.
Advisory Board Member Gaffney.
Aye.
Advisory Board Member Nava.
Aye.
Advisory Board Member Goldman.
Aye.
Chair Rogers.
Aye.
Okay, and now who wants to be on it?
I would be interested to be on it. I have some questions myself about traffic.
And I think, Robert, you indicated you'd like to participate. I think you'd be great because you have a lot of experience in this. So I hope that you would join.
Happy to.
Okay, great. And Lori, I think you'd be good too, just on the whole idea of outlining how this is going to work.
I will, but I don't want to take anyone else's spot. So
to reiterate, this is just to form, just to make the plan on how, set it up, how to appeal these things and how
right.
to, mm-hmm. So it's that's not right. a meeting that goes, I mean, a committee that goes on forever.
Correct.
Okay. Well, Ian, this is your big chance. I don't want you to miss out if you are interested in participating.
I am interested, but I do have a lot kind of on my plate right now. So I would let.
Okay.
Or, and honestly, you know, Mr. Irwin might want to get in on that as well.
Yeah, well, you can only have three, and it sounds yeah. like we've got three.
So I'm and, okay right now.
That's all right. I spoke up for him on the pavement stuff. I'm kind of on top of Eric there in our $2 million budget item. So, okay, it looks like we've got three people who are interested. Director Kowalik?
Thank you for the direction. I think we're good to go.
Okay, so is that all we need to discuss on that item?
Yes.
All right, well then let's move on. Thank you, everyone, to future agenda items, which we have some nice carry forwards there already, as you can see. We have a quarterly report coming up again, when would potentially that be due? In September?
In August.
In August? All right. And a capital project review again? We just went through last month, I think.
Yeah, we plan on bringing that back every other meeting.
Okay. Good. Okay. And, of course, the tree replacement plan I'm very interested in. And the sidewalk repair project, is that, I guess that's the concrete thing that you alluded to, Eric?
Yeah, as you would expect, we have countless locations where we have issues with sidewalk due to uplift and other circumstances.
Okay.
But, we have a very small project we're doing right now.
Yeah.
Want to add that one of the agenda items that was brought up last time, future, would be the transit hub, and we probably will have a development on that for next meeting, but we'll see if that's either August or September would be a good time to do that.
All right. Okay. Good. Are there any other items that we should consider? Should anybody want to speak up? All right. So thank you. I think that we have a lot of good future items. So with that, I'm going to adjourn our meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
You all.
The next meeting will be in August, August 17th at 5:30. Hopefully we'll be back in person. I'm sorry to say it's almost 20 minutes to 9, so I'm sorry I let you guys just run wild tonight.
Then good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you, everyone.